Hello everyone, this is a call out for your help. We've now been curating Herbal Reality for the last 5 years, and it's thanks to the support of the Earthsong Foundation that we've had the funds to get to where we are now. As we seek to build on this work and protect our future, we're now looking for your support too. So in order to keep Herbal Reality a herbalist-led, ad-free, open-access herbal medicine platform, we're looking to raise £25,000 over the next few months, and are asking for a contribution of £3 from you, or however much you feel able to give. £3 is just the cost of a cup of herbal tea, so if you've enjoyed any of the articles and podcasts that we've shared over the past 5 years, and you believe in our vision for an open-access, free resource that champions herbal medicine, please follow the link to our Just Giving campaign. Every pound will be matched funded by the Earthsong Foundation, so in effect your money will be doubled. Over the past 5 years, we've published over 700 free access articles, produced 4 seasons of our podcast called Herbcast, promoted thousands of herbal events, and signposted numerous clients for herbalist consultations. And we have ambitious plans for ahead. To the 2.5 million readers who have visited our website, the 20,000 subscribers who have signed up to our newsletter, and the hundreds of thousands of you listeners who have tuned into our Herbcast, we would really like to thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Your collective support has made Herbal Reality the engaged global herbal community that it is today. All this support means so much to us. As fellow travellers riding the surge of interest in natural health and the renaissance of modern herbal medicine, let's work together for the good of the whole community. Please donate now and be a part of the future success of herbal medicine. Thank you. Hello everyone, herb lovers, sustainable health seekers, herbal medicine fans. Welcome back to Herbcast, our podcast from Herbal Reality. In every episode, we explore how traditional wisdom and up-to-date herbal science can meet the needs of the hour and support a sustainable and effective approach to our health. As you know, herbs have nourished human health for thousands of years, and whilst they hold so much potential to meet today's numerous health challenges, there are still so many questions to be answered. And we're delighted to have you with us today as we continue to deepen our understanding together. So get comfy, pour yourself a cup of herbal tea, and let's begin.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this episode of Herbcast. I'm Eve, editor of our written content at Herbal Reality, and I'm making my Herbcast debut today with herbalist Simon Mills, as we discuss using herbs during pregnancy. Simon really needs no introduction as a seasoned Herbcast host himself, and owing to his active and long-standing presence in the herbal community since becoming a practitioner in 1977. Simon is the author of many books, such as the renowned Principles and Practice of Phytotherapy that you'll find on the bookshelf of many a herbalist, but a book of Simon's that is especially relevant to our conversation today is The Essential Guide to Herbal Safety, as we discuss using herbs safely in pregnancy. Simon, hello. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, and thank you for hosting this.
So I mentioned your book that you co-authored with Kerry Bone on the topic of safety. Obviously, safety is an imperative consideration when treating anybody with herbs, but it is especially so with pregnancy. And I wonder, Simon, why especially is that, and what are the risks?
Well, the first answer to any question around herbs and pregnancy is that nobody knows. For most things, there's a few exceptions where we've checked, and there's been research with humans, with women who are pregnant, but these are very much exceptions. So most of what we do in pregnancy is be careful, because clearly things have shifted. We have not only the woman herself to look after, but a new person coming along. And so we always take the precautionary principle, don't put anything in there unless we need it. And particularly in our first trimester, when organs are being developed, so the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, we try as far as possible not to use herbs. And if a patient of mine who is being treated says that she's pregnant, then I will immediately suggest stop the herbs until we know what we need to do. So the first principle is you know, unless you need it, just back off. We'll talk about the exceptions. We'll talk about things that you can do. And obviously, we'll talk about things that may need treating in pregnancy. But that would be the first principle, simply because there's so little evidence of what actually does happen with herbs in pregnancy. And there are some where we know there are problems because they were identified as potentially ending pregnancies. And we'll come on to those later.
Okay. And so how would you say that herbs are then evaluated safe or unsafe?
Almost all the safety data we've had on herbs, with a few exceptions, and that's in general now, is reactive. In other words, it's observations of events that have happened, adverse effects reported to someone or another, and sometimes accumulated by trawling through records. So some authors are well known to look for safety data and pull them together and come up with some conclusions. But almost all the data we got on herbs is people reporting them having caused or being associated with a problem. And sometimes that association is tight. More often it's not clear. So unlike efficacy, where it is possible to do randomized controlled clinical trials and show an observable effect with a herb against a placebo or another treatment, there's almost nothing like that done on safety. So we again have to make a professional judgment if we're being asked about whether to use the herb safely. And, you know, our judgments will differ. We vary from being gung-ho to very cautious as practitioners. So I tend to be on the slightly cautious end of that spectrum.
And of the herbs that you mentioned, that some herbs can pose a risk to ending the pregnancy, is there a specific type of herbs that have a particular quality?
We think so. Well, the first word to get onto the list is the word emmenogog, which is often used in herbal books and texts as a description of a herb. And I think we just need to pause before we apply that word, because it's sometimes associated in some texts with being good for women in some way or another, or good for menstrual cycles or whatever. I mean, the original meaning of the word was to bring on the menses, to bring on the period. And if you're living in a earlier time, and you're a woman who, you know, doesn't have many birth control opportunities, you often dread a late period because it's often implies that there is a baby coming along, and you may not be ready for that. You may not want it, and you may not want to tell the potential father about it either. Very frequently, you had recourse to what we call emmenogogs, remedies that would bring on a late period. It doesn't take much of a, you know, genius to recognize that probably means that they were in effect early abortifacients. So when we look at the herbs that were used as emmenogogs, the ones that stand out are those that are quite strong in their impact on anybody, let alone during pregnancy. You know, a classic example in Britain was rue, R-U-E, Ruta graveolens, which was often used for that purpose. A lot of the members of the wormwood family were used. Artemisia were used for that. Some other strong bitters were used. Strong volatile oils, so neat, or oils from things like oregano, juniper, those sort of things. Tansy would have been used, tenacetum vulgare. These were remedies that a pennyroyal, of course, a version of the mint was often used, again, particularly as an oil. Male fern, one of the drastic purgative remedies, and other purgatives would have been used often in desperation to bring about an early period. Those would automatically enter our lists as remedies to avoid. And it's not so much because they induce contractions, which is what people often think, is probably because some of them actually threaten or interfere with the nutrition or the hormonal control of the womb at that point. And the risk then is that if used in anything other than a very careful way, expert way, you know, there were some particularly women who had a reputation for using them, but for many, using them could pose a risk not to the pregnancy but to the baby, particularly as by definition are using them very early on where the baby's organs are developing. So there's a list of those strong herbs that we simply say avoid because they're too dangerous.
So there is a general consensus, as in your book, Kerry mentions that there's often an inconsistency on whether herbs are safe or unsafe. And he mentions yes. herbs like echinacea, fennel, chamomile. And so is there now more of a consensus over?
Well, funnily, there are just a handful of herbs that have been shown to be safe when women have taken them. And echinacea is one of them. Chamomile is another. There are fairly good suggestions that fennel, at least in moderate quantity, is also safe. But those are, and ginger, we'll talk about ginger, I'm sure, later, because that's clearly a remedy that is available. But yeah, I mean, let's take some of those. If you look at conventional or other textbooks about herbs, including some of the well-known safety books, authors, you know, writing books need to be careful because, you know, there's lawyers out there. And so they tend to err on the side of saying don't when there's a issue about using a herb in pregnancy that you don't understand. So you'll find that many authors have a longer list of herbs to avoid than, for example, my book with Kerry, which tends to take a slightly more relaxed view. But even, you know, we do tend to be careful. So ginger is a classic example of a herb that we can, and we'll come on to when to use it later, but we can easily recommend it to reduce sickness, for example. But you'll find many authorities saying don't use it because there are theoretical issues with it. And, you know, we have to balance what the theory from the reality of, you know, the real world situation. So, yeah, ginger is one of the ones that is probably acceptable. Echinacea has got evidence to show it is acceptable. A lot of women are concerned about herbs with phytoestrogens in them because they theoretically have, by definition, estrogenic effect. Again, we need to remind ourselves that a phytoestrogen is, by definition, a very weak estrogen and therefore acts, in effect, as an estrogen blocker. So it's not the full-on estrogen that you might assume with a name like that. It actually tends to dampen down the estrogen response. So you might think, well, you know, perhaps we ought to be careful with things like soya or linseed in pregnancy, but the evidence is quite strong. I mean, obviously, there are parts of the world where they eat soya constantly. If anything, pregnancy data shows that they are not only safe, but seem to help a healthy pregnancy. So phytoestrogens like soya and linseed are on the tick list of things that are fairly safe. There are one or two others, interestingly, that are shown to be safe. Turmeric, you might imagine, given that it's a food that women have used constantly, whether or not they're pregnant, that's safe, as well as ginger, as you said. Interestingly, ginseng, Panax ginseng, there's quite a lot of positive safety data on that from China and Korea. So I think that's got a tick as well.
You mentioned using ginger for morning sickness. Which herbs come to mind, or have you found especially valuable in supporting pregnant women throughout their pregnancy for pregnancy related?
Yes. Well, back to the question now, do we need to do this? And one of the most common reasons for wanting to use herbs is being sick, morning sickness. It's common, especially in the first trimester, when the body is readjusting essentially to this new situation. There's a big shift in hormones. There's obviously a shift in immune activity because there's a new person there. So there's quite a lot of upheaval that can translate as feeling sick. And the thing about ginger is that it works very directly on the sickness sensors in the stomach. So it is a very direct way of reducing some of the signals that give rise to the sick feeling. And you can easily titrate it. You can easily build the dose up. So you can start with a simple ginger tea that you can, you know, buy a ginger bag with ginger in it, or you can simply grate fresh ginger, a small amount into a mug, and take that as a tea and see immediately how it feels. I always say with herbs that the best guide to one to use them is yourself. You try them in small doses, see how they feel, and if it feels sort of okay, build up the dose. The effect of ginger is immediate, so you won't take long to feel whether it's a good thing. Usually that's the way to start, and it could be you make a tea, it could be that you chew a crystallized ginger. Could have a capsule even of ginger extract, but I would always prefer to use it as a tea. If that doesn't work, that's when I think you will need some professional judgment, because there are other approaches that could reduce the sick feeling. Ginger is a warming herb, and if that doesn't work, it could mean that what you need is something more cooling, to use the old language, and that usually translates as bitters. Now, for example, if you were working on your own to help with the sickness, you might try first something like dandelion root as a tea again. You'd need to grind it up to get the juice out, or cook it for a while, because it is a hard woody substance root. So you might need to cook it gently rather than just pour hot water on it. But make yourself a dandelion tea or coffee, if you like, and sip that and see if that feels any better. And if it does, then that may be the direction to go. And dandelion is inherently very safe, so one could be quite happy with that. But if that's where you're heading and you're still not getting quite the deal you want, then it may be that you're looking for some other slightly more active digestive remedies with bitters in them. And that's where you might want a little bit of help. There are one or two bitters that we avoid because they're just a little bit on the risky side. In fact, I think what I can do is just review what we used back in that book. We used, there are some guides to safety in pregnancy out there. The FDA in America's got one. We've got our own basic one over here in UK and Europe. But we chose the one that's used in Australia for the Therapeutic Goods Administration, which has a much bigger range of options. And essentially, we have category A, which is where there's evidence that it is safe in women, in pregnant women, mainly because they are part of the diet. So turmeric and indeed ginger come into that. And there are others, echinacea, as we said, that come into that, chamomile, that come into that because of the evidence. So category A is almost certainly safe, but it's a small list. So we then have category B, which is broken down into three levels. And because all of those levels have in common that there's not much human evidence for safety, we start with the basis that a lot of women, pregnant women, have used them, or a significant number. So category B is where there has been use by women. And then there's B1, B2, B3. B1 is where, on the whole, other evidence, and this usually comes from animals, I'm afraid, suggests that it is safe. B2 is when such animal data suggests there might be a problem, but it's not that likely to be significant. And B3 suggests where there is such laboratory evidence and it could pose a slightly bigger issue. And I'll come back and suggest herbs that fit into each of those categories in a moment. Then we have category C, which is where there is little evidence that women have used this when they were pregnant, and there is some evidence of concern. Category D is when there is evidence of concern, and we would not recommend these herbs. And category X is where we would definitely say don't use. So we're excluding categories C and D, and I'll just make sure that we've covered what herbs I have in those categories in a moment. We're saying category B is professional judgment can often make the difference between using it or not using it. And obviously, if it's category B1, it's more likely to be safe than category B3. So category A, we've already got mentioned ginger, we've mentioned echinacea, chamomile is in there, ginseng is in there, Panax ginseng, turmeric is in there, bilberry is in there. And you can see that, you know, that's clearly a food. Interestingly, and we'll talk about that later, raspberry leaf is there, which does deserve a comment all of its own. We'll come on to that. And we put senna in there. Now, that's counterintuitive to many people because they assume that senna is dangerous because it's a laxative. And I'm going to put a caution around that and maybe come back to the laxatives later. But actually, there is evidence that women who were pregnant, taken senna without a problem. And there are occasions when you do need help with the bowels in pregnancy. So we'll put a little bracket around that. But, you know, paradoxically, you wouldn't think it, but there is evidence to show that it has been used safely in pregnancy. So it fits into category A. So category B1, which is the less sure but probably okay, includes valerian, it includes ginkgo, it includes St. John's wort. And, you know, obviously the issue is that St. John's wort is more to do with interactions, but on its own, it seems to be all right. And one or two other remedies like bupleurum are in there from Asia. Category B2, when there's a little bit more care, is including astragalus buccu and black cohosh. We'll talk about blue cohosh later. Category B3, where we're getting on the edge of uncertainty here and probably not recommend using this, include andrographis and bicryl skullcap. So those two are on the edge of being okay. So those are the, you know, potential contenders for treatment in pregnancy. We get a little unhappier when we get into category C, and that includes bearberry or Uva ursi, after Staphylos, otherwise known, and the berberines, golden seal, barberry, the Phelodendron coptis, all those with the berberine alkaloids, we would put in category C. In category D, we've got rue, I've already mentioned, adadota from Asia, and pau d'arco from South America are in that category. And then definitely no-nos, the category X include aristolochia, as you could imagine, the ragwort, senecio, boldo, poke root. So those are a spectrum of herbs from being possibly, probably okay to being definitely not, just to give you a flavor. But, you know, there's only a handful of the 100 or so herbs on our shelves. And for the most of them, we just don't know.
I'm especially surprised to hear of senna in category A. with my understanding being that laxatives are generally one to avoid, especially anthraquinone laxatives.
Yes. And I would, in spite of them being category A, I would be very careful in using them because, you know, laxatives can induce, depending on your dose and your predilection to them, they can induce a more extreme visceral spasm. But remember that that is the bowel. It's very localized to the bowel. The whole mechanism for Senna and the anthraquinones are that they irritate the bowel lining, so to speak. So there's no direct or even indirect effect on the womb. And by the way, just to jump ahead to another conversation, there's very little evidence that they get through in the breast milk either. So they do, are very restricted to the bowel. So the question is the extra irritation in the bowel likely to lead to an increased risk to a pregnancy? And I think the answer would only be if that risk would only be if the effect of the Senna was drastic and you got a general visceral upheaval, which might have a knock-on effect on the womb. But there's very little evidence that anthraquinones directly affect the womb at all. And, you know, I suppose the answer to the question of whether to use it is don't, like everything else. But there are some cases where constipation is such a threat to the health of a woman that we have to consider the options and obviously go for the fiber. But, you know, as women often report, there comes a point in the pregnancy when you just don't want much down there at all. You know, it's pretty full. So the idea of having, you know, spoonfuls of fiber doesn't seem very attractive. And it sometimes isn't enough. So the question about whether to use a more stimulating laxative is actually a very real clinical issue that does arise. And what Kerry and I are saying is don't balk at the prospect of using it. Start titrate, start low, and see if a low dose can make a difference. And, you know, but only use it when you really need to. But there is evidence, there are clinical trials to show that, and studies that show that using Senna is not associated with a risk to pregnancy outcomes. It's obviously better if you're used to using them before the pregnancy and you know where you stand with them.
Hi there, Sebastian here. If you're enjoying this episode, you might like to know there are plenty more herbal insights on our website. Come and discover more on the science, tradition, and practical use of herbs at herbalreality.com. You can check out our special features such as our herb library, where we have monographs written by clinical practitioners on over 200 herbs used in Western, Chinese, and Ayurvedic herbal traditions. We cover the traditional use, modern research, how practitioners use the herbs in clinic, any quality and safety data, as well as a sustainability listing, so you know how to safely use the best quality herbs in a way that protects your health and that of the planet. You can search herbs by the action, grouping them all together, say for immunity or by energetic function, all the immunological, heating or cooling herbs in one place. You can also sign up for our newsletter for plant-powered wisdom delivered straight to your inbox for the most up-to-date information. Right, let's get back to today's conversation.
You mentioned a general rule of thumb about not using herbs in the first trimester. We've kind of already given an exception there with ginger for morning sickness. So going into the second and third trimester, are there any herbs? I have raspberry leaf in mind, and others that would be especially ones to think of.
Well, I've specifically not mentioned licorice. I worked for Pucker for 8 years, and we had quite a lot of licorice in our teas. There is evidence, mainly from Scandinavia, that shows that heavy consumption of licorice is associated with the wrong sort of outcomes, mainly reduced birth weight and potential high blood pressure in the woman. And as I was working at Pucker, the levels of safe use of licorice were lowered by new data coming in. And this is because we're talking about countries, Scandinavia and Finland being one group, but Netherlands being another, where a lot of people eat a lot of licorice in candy form. And so our first response to those bits of evidence were that they related to the use of licorice along with some salt, which is often used in the candy, and sugar, and that you will probably be safer with licorice in a purer form or in a tea or in a medicine. However, there has been a lot of data, and I was responsible at Pucker for adding it all up and coming to a calculation. And essentially, I think there is a dose above which perhaps you shouldn't go. It equates to 250 milligrams of glycyrrhizin per week, which translates into about 7 to 10 grams of licorice root per week as probably an upper level beyond which you shouldn't go. That we had at Pucker one tea, which was just called free licorice, which essentially meant there was solid licorice. And we calculated that one tea bag a day would get you pretty close to that limit. So we actually put a warning on the label of that one. Probably don't take that when you're pregnant, simply to be careful. The issue with licorice, as you many of you will know who are listening to this, is that it is inherently hypertensive. Its hormonal effects actually increase the hormones that lead to water retention. So all licorice tends to put up your blood pressure. And when you're pregnant, there is an added risk of blood pressure going up. It's called preeclampsia. And in full blown, it's eclampsia, which is a serious condition. But preeclampsia is not uncommon in pregnant women. And what it means is that their blood pressure goes up above their normal. And that relates almost certainly to the fact that the kidneys are under more strain. They've actually got to deal with their clearing two bodies, especially towards the end of pregnancy rather than one. And means that they are more liable to wanting more blood pressure to do the filtering properly. So the kidneys put the blood pressure up. And licorice in that situation could help them to do that more. So in the case of licorice, probably the first thing is don't use it, really, just to be on the safe side. But if you do use it, keep the dose low. And most licorice-flavored tea bags have you need 5 or 6 or 10 of those a day to bring yourself up to the limit. In the Pucker range, we calculated that. So, you know, if it's a licorice-flavored tea, you're not going to be concerned unless you have a huge amount of them. But if you're talking medicinal licorice, keep it low at least, and particularly watch your blood pressure. And if there's any sign that it's going up, back off the licorice even. So that's one example of a remedy that you'd watch, particularly actually later in the pregnancy, because that's when preeclampsia is more likely to show itself. And you'd be more concerned about things like birth weight and so on. Licorice, keep it low if you use it at all. Now, you mentioned raspberry leaf. Interestingly, that there's almost no evidence, by the way, of any adverse effect. And there is some evidence that it is used quite commonly in certainly English-speaking countries. The reputation has preceded it, so it's used a lot in places like Australia and US later in the pregnancy. The idea being that it helps prepare for delivery, for term. helps. We know we talk about it as helping the womb contractions to be more coordinated and to be more effective and efficient. And a lot of midwives in these countries are quite open and even encourage the women that they're helping to use Ras Relief. And I think it's particularly towards the end of the cycle, at the end of the pregnancy. So if you're thinking about Ras Relief, don't even bother doing it until the last trimester. Much better to leave it actually until a month or so before due date. And then you could start drinking it as a tea and building it up to, you know, an effective dose, you know, an ounce of dried raspberry leaf to a pint of water over a couple of days is probably an effective dose as you get close to term. And there is quite a lot of evidence to show, anecdotal evidence, but a little bit more as well, that it does seem to help with delivery. But I wouldn't bother using it until close to the end.
And Simon, we've mentioned teas a lot as a herbal preparation. And as herbalists, we use a vast array, often in the form of tincture, alcoholic preparation. And yes. So is that generally advised against in pregnancy? And what other preparations, such as teas or other things, would you recommend?
Well, you know, I always use tinctures and extracts in my practice. And so the question is, do I use those with my pregnant patients? And I will always start with suggesting teas, because a water extractive is by definition less likely to bring out things like alkaloids and other potentially more active elements in the plant. So a tea is by definition, an aqueous extraction is by definition the safest. Similar glycerates, they tend to leave some of them alkaloids and other things behind as well. So the question is, are tinctures safe? And the answer, of course, comes back, what are you giving in tincture form? If there are no particular issues with alkaloids, which are always the ones that are more likely to be an issue, then you're probably okay. I mean, some women prefer not to have any alcohol at all. Understandably, there's quite a lot of data to suggest that drinking alcohol is not such a good idea in pregnancy. Obviously, the doses that we give are so low, there's not to make much impact on that. So I'm not so concerned about the alcohol content. And sometimes you can recommend a woman who is, or anyone else who's concerned about the alcohol content in the tinctures, to put it in a little container and add the same amount of water alpha, hot water from the kettle, and that'll blow off most of the alcohol. You know, remember, alcohol's boiling point is 79 degrees, whereas water is 100 degrees. So if you put boiling water in there, you're going to blow off a good portion of the alcohol, and that will make it even more acceptable. So I don't hold out against tinctures per se, but just be aware that tinctures are more likely to extract alkaloids. They're also more likely, of course, to extract volatiles. And we haven't talked too much about those, but, you know, I did mention earlier that some of the essential oils were used as emmenagogues, possibly to help shorten the pregnancy. And there is some evidence to suggest that if you use essential oils, that you could expose yourself to slightly more risk. Although people like Tisserand and others who've looked at this as specialists in volatile oils tend to reassure us that there isn't that much evidence for that either. But if you're slightly concerned about that, then tinctures, of course, will up the volatile oil content of your herbs.
Okay. And glycerites as well, are they a preparation that you use in practice?
Only a few, but yes, they tend to be gentler by definition.
And again, just have the aqueous extract.
Aqueous is the best option, yeah.
Which herbs? I'm wondering, you've mentioned ginger and raspberry leaf.
Yes.
Which other herbs have you found especially valuable in treating women?
Chamomile, we've only briefly mentioned, but again, it'll help if you've got that tummy upset, queasiness perhaps. It's got a tick alongside it. So again, you can titrate. You can start with a low dose, one tea bag, for example, in a cup. And then if it seems to be helpful, go up to 2 to 3. I think you're quite safe to take a higher dose if it's going to work. If it works, I mean, then I think you're safe enough with that sort of level. The thing about those, ginger and chamomile, and we mentioned dandelion root, their effect is almost instant. So don't press ahead using those if there is not an immediate benefit. There's no point. I would add with chamomile, lemon balm. It doesn't usually feature on people's lists, but I have no reason to believe there's any problem with it. And again, it can help with that upset stomach a lot. On the more positive level, remember that we need more nourishment in pregnancy. And everyone knows about folic acid. And, you know, it's commonly used as a supplement, and I fully approve of that because it's such an obvious one to take. If you're having a vegetable diet, particularly with dark greens, you're going to get good folic acid levels. But the one that often is missed out in terms of nourishment is iron. And you do really need to make sure your iron intake is bolstered during pregnancy. And if you're not eating meat, then you do have to be careful that you are having some form of iron. Ironically, of course, some of the best forms are in red wine, which may not feature on your list as when you're pregnant. Nettle tea. Nettle actually is one of the remedies that I would definitely add as a goodie in pregnancy because it has got those minerals in it. And, you know, even things like molasses, which obviously has a bit of a sugar content, but it's, if you get the proper blackstrap stuff, not very much, is so rich with useful nutrients that a vegetarian, for example, might find that useful. But yeah, be aware that you will need more minerals, particularly folic acid and vitamin D. Vitamin D is another one that you may want to look to supplement, because again, that seems to be important in pregnancy, and you won't find that in plants very much.
Okay. And I wonder about kind of thinking now postpartum and the safety of herbs with breastfeeding. Is there still the same level of considerations in whether it's safe to take herbs during breastfeeding, or is there any more data about whether herbs pass into the breast milk?
Well, interestingly, because the one category that people use for breastfeeding is ND, no data. And the vast majority of plants that we use or could use have no data for them at all. So it's very much suck it and see in a way. There's two issues, actually. But the main one, well, the first issue is that we wonder what gets through into the breast milk if the mother is lactating, of course. Not an issue if there's bottle feeding. But if the mother's lactating, then what is getting through to the baby? So that's the first issue. And the answer, again, is that in many cases we don't know. We can assume that high volatiles of the aromatics, these spices and the flavoring herbs you have in the kitchen, for example, a lot of those will get through the breast milk because they're easily transferred into the lipid section. compartment of the body, and so you might expect to see them coming through. And there are anecdotal reports of women who had a very flavored meal, smelling the herbs on the baby's breath. So that we know that is quite likely. Garlic is one of those, isn't it, that can easily transfer across. The two points of that: A, could that be doing the baby harm? And again, mostly we don't know, although the overall risks to a full emerged baby are slightly less, unknown, if you like, because we can see it, they poo more or whatever, than it, when they're in utero. So mostly we're not too, agitated about this. But there is another side to this, which, of course, could the transfusion of herbal ingredients into the breast milk actually be a remedy? And, as a practitioner, I get suckling babies as patients, and I will always first deal with them through their mother if they are breastfeeding, and particularly colic. Many of the spices, if the mother eats them, will translate into a reduction in colic in their baby. Fennel is a classic example. There's been all sorts of mixed messages about fennel, because it used to be widely used in colic, for colic in many traditions. There's some concern about its, ingredients in the long term, certainly. Some authorities will suggest you don't use fennel at all when you're pregnant or breastfeeding. I think we can be fairly relaxed about it, certainly in breastfeeding, because experience shows that if a mother who's breastfeeding takes fennel as a remedy, that it can reduce colic in their baby. So again, short-term use, try it, see if it helps. If it doesn't help, no point carrying on. You can do that with any of the aromatic kitchen herbs. Try it, see if it helps with the baby. So there's a potential way in which you could treat upset baby problems through the mother. So that's one positive. There's the other group of remedies which had a reputation for being galactagogues. In other words, plants that women took to improve or increase their breast production, their breast milk production. And chaste tree is one of ours that has that reputation. Fenugreek is another. Fennel also has a reputation. Many of the Asian spices would have been used to help with improving breast milk. So when that is the case, we tend to say, well, those must be safe. Let's give them a tick.
I suppose also the other side of that is drying herbs like sage that actually can be useful with weaning.
Yes. You mean putting it on the baby's gums or the mother taking them?
The mother taking them. I think the opposite to a galactagogue.
Yeah, sage is another one of those ones, going back to pregnancy now, where there has been mixed messages. My judgment is that taking sage in a moderate form for most purposes, certainly in flavouring and cooking and so on, is almost certainly okay. But if you were to take a large amount of sage, you might just get a bit of upset. And again, for a breastfeeding mother to take a large amount of sage could go either way. It might upset the mother. There's a mixed potential with the baby. But yes, teething is one of those cases when that's suggested.
And so, Simon, in general, what advice would you give to any pregnant woman that is seeking to use herbs during pregnancy?
Don't, unless you need to. That's whistling in the wind in a way, because the evidence suggests, depending on where you ask the question, who asks it, up to a half of women are taking supplements of one sort or another in pregnancy when they're pregnant. Interestingly, well over half sometimes more like three quarters, still carry on taking their prescription medicines from the doctor, and the doctor very rarely tells them to stop, in spite of the fact that, you know, we've been talking about herbs as having an unknown data sheet. Well, most prescription medicines have an unknown data sheet as well in pregnancy, and yet doctors often don't think twice about their pregnant patients carrying on. So let's put what we're talking about into a bigger context here. We're being rarely careful in this conversation now, but the wider world out there seems to be quite more gung-ho about all this. So, but my advice as a prudent practitioner and as a father and multiple grandfather is to use herbs in pregnancy only when you need them, just to be on the ultra safe side.
Okay, thank you. Is there anything that I've not asked you about that you think?
Let me just check my little notes and see, shall we? Oh, a couple of herbs which I spotted potentially should be on our list not to take, including ephedra, which is on schedule herb anyway for practitioner only. Neem, I suspect that's rarely anything that's really bitter. We might put that on the list. The pyrrolizine alkaloids, the ones you get in comfrey and again ragwort. And
hepatotoxicity concerns.
Hepatotoxicity concerns. We don't know where we are with that, but there's one or two issues have come up with those, even things like coltsfoot, where again one would suggest don't use those in pregnancy.
Well, thank you, Simon, for sharing all of your wisdom on safety during pregnancy.
Well, I'm just sorry that I haven't personally been on that journey myself, but I have been with very many women who have, and so I share their stories a little.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eve.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. We hope today's conversation has planted a seed of inspiration and deepened your understanding of herbal medicine, even answered a question or two. Please do subscribe to Herbcast wherever you're listening to this right now, and you'll be sure to never miss an episode. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and share it with someone who'd enjoy it too. As they say, learn something, teach something. It really helps us to reach more people and spread the good herbal world. You can also use a podcast review to share your comments and feedback about Herbcast, or perhaps make a suggestion for a future episode. It's always great to hear your views. If you can't wait till the next episode, you'll find plenty more herbal insights and all the previous Herbcast episodes on our website, and of course on social media. All the links you need are in the episode show notes. Until next time, take care, and thanks again for joining us for another episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. Bye for now.